Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
We're already looking at having to cut 2/3 of our staff, that we're going to see children below the age of 3 on the streets of Tucson with their families.
Congress could cut more than $100 million in funding to migrant shelters. We'll hear from one of them in Arizona. Thursday, March 21st, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, this year's World Happiness Report finds the U.S. is slipping in the rankings, especially among young people. And a data analyst hired by the Trump campaign to find widespread fraud in the 2020 election didn't find it. But that's not what the White House at the time wanted to hear.
The voter fraud claims that have no basis of foundation of fact are political theater, and they have nothing to do with what actually happened in the election.
Before we get to that, though, members of Congress now have 2 days to wade through a huge compromise budget deal. It's more than 1,000 pages long. If passed before the end of the day tomorrow, it'll avert a partial government shutdown. And when it comes to immigration, the bill promises more money for border agents and detention beds, as well as significant cuts to funding for non-governmental organizations that provide transportation, shelter, and food to migrants who cross the border. For a closer look at what that would mean, we called up one of those groups that could be seeing cuts. Casa Alitas is a shelter in Tucson that is part of Catholic Community Services of Southern Arizona. Diego Pina Lopez is executive director. He spoke to Deepa Fernandez.
So, Diego, potential cuts to groups like yours are significant, maybe even 20%. What would a cut of that size mean to your daily operations?
With the funding getting cut that much, the likelihood that we will see street releases in a community that has never seen street releases will drastically increase, where I might start off having to make the decision that we're only going to limit our services to families coming through. And then we would see single males from typically nationalities across the world being released in our Tucson community.
And Diego, one of the things that I know your shelter has seen is a rise in the number of people who have come through. So in some ways, your services are already being pushed to the limit. Can you tell us, you know, how many people you're serving?
Our numbers fluctuate, as you can imagine, with the seasons, with storms, with the political climate of home countries and what's going on in Mexico, and as well as on our border. So we projected last year to see 750 per day. We went to over 1,800 days for several days.
What are you hearing from people as to why they're coming in greater numbers in the last few years?
You know, we've just come out of the pandemic, and I think still a lot of countries, even our own, are still reeling through the consequences of that, as well as we're seeing so many displaced people globally. Last year, I was seeing people from Mauritania, and we're still seeing people from there, of a country where slavery was just outlawed 7 years ago. You know, right now, we're starting to see an increase of people from Haiti coming through with the issues there. But also, we're seeing many people from our southern neighbor, Mexico, claiming asylum. And that's the lion's share of the people coming through right now, about 40% in our area. And most of these people in our area are also families with children at a tender age.
So given that, what are people's needs? It sounds like people are coming from all over, very different places, escaping different things. What are their needs and how do you help them?
You know, many people might have experienced, like I said, slavery or or violence from their government and so forth. So recognizing, you know, they need to understand where they are in the community. Some of them are crossing all the way in Douglas, so an hour and a half east of where we are in Tucson, helping them understand where Tucson is, how to buy a plane ticket. Some folks think you can just go to the airport to buy a plane ticket, which is not the case here. Also medical needs. About 4.7% of our guests have a medical need, anything from dehydration to diabetes medication that they need refill from, to separation of families, a husband and wife coming through. Maybe had an instance of a family coming from Cameroon where the wife was released and the husband was released several days later. You know, culturally not acceptable, and / she did not have the resources to go to their sponsor. Nevertheless, that sponsor, that relative, was his relative. So the challenges that she faced with that, and her hope and really pleading to see her husband come to us.
Mm. So I want to ask you, you know, some lawmakers say aid agencies like yours incentivize migrants to come, and then they just make up a story when they get here and claim asylum, which sounds like a different story to what you might be hearing when you talk to migrants directly. Is that the reason why we're seeing so many more coming, because there are shelters like yours that welcome them?
I don't think we can say it's on the shelters having a ability to serve. You know, we're using a former call center as a shelter in a juvenile court building that we've modified to our welcome center to support asylum seekers. So I don't think the comforts that you're getting in our shelters are the reasons people are claiming asylum as much as what is going on in their home country. Some of them might have a history of being enslaved, like the Mauritanians that have been coming through in the past, to the violence that we're seeing in Haiti right now, as well as violence with the cartels or corruption with their police, and as well as their freedom of religion.
And what would happen if, say, you had to shut your doors or cut your staff in half and cancel contracts, like you said you might have to do?
Well, right now we're already looking at having to cut 2/3 of our staff come April 1st. And with that, it greatly limits the ability of services for people. And we're going to see upwards to several hundred people on the street per day being released. And that's not including those from the day before. So we will see the number stacking on top of itself. That we're going to see children below the age of 3 on the streets of Tucson with their families, and people that are medically vulnerable. I think the biggest concern for me come April 1st is we're talking about maybe a single mother with a several-month-old baby and thinking about trafficking and other terrible things that could possibly happen there.
Mm. Diego Pina Lopez is executive director of Casa Alitas, a migrant aid agency that Catholic Community Services of Southern Arizona operates in Tucson. Diego, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, are you happy? It can be a loaded question for sure. But an annual survey tries to get a gauge on how people are feeling around the world every year. After the break, we'll hear from one of the authors of the latest report, which found that the U.S. is slipping out of the top 20 happiest countries, largely thanks to a huge happiness gap between young and old. Celeste Headley has the story when we return.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
A survey of happiness around the globe shows that Americans today are not as happy as they used to be. For the first time, the U.S. dropped out of the top 20 happiest countries, and the Americans who are most likely to say they're unhappy are under 30 years old. John Helliwell helped write the report, and he's here to tell us more. So, Professor, happiness means a lot of different things. How do you measure it?
The main measure we use in most of the science of well-being, but especially in the Gallup World Poll, is to ask people, as Aristotle suggested centuries ago, about their life as a whole. The particular question that we use in our report is one that says, think of your life as a ladder, with the best possible life as a 10 and the worst as a 0. How would you rate your life today?
And yet you are ranking countries based on happiness. Why are some countries full of people considered happier than others? Is it because of income, healthcare, education, crime rate?
It's typically more than that, but some of those things come into play. So it's related to things like crime rate and so on, because it really depends on whether people feel that they belong, that they're surrounded by trustworthy people, that other people will watch their back. One of the experimental things that separates the happy countries from the not happy countries is dropping wallets and asking people also whether they think their lost wallet would be returned. Mm-hmm. In the countries that normally show up as the happiest ones, people expect their wallets to be returned more than in other countries, and if they're experimentally dropped, they are returned. Unfortunately, all over the world, people are too pessimistic about how nice other people are. So they underestimate, often several fold, the likelihood of their wallet actually being returned. So, of course, they're surprised when it is.
What are the implications for health and life expectancy depending on rankings?
That's a very good question. Your own health depends on your own feelings of happiness. There's a lot of work now linking up these measures of happiness with subsequent medical and health records of people for many, many years. And it's a clear dose-response relation that the greater your positive feelings and how well you feel about your life, the less morbidity and the lower mortality. And you can see why that would be.
I noticed that Israel was ranked as the fifth happiest country in the world. That is despite the data being collected after the Israel-Hamas war began in October. At the same time, Palestine ranked as number 103 out of 143, although their survey was done before October. What do you make of that?
Well, the state of Palestine has always ranked low, and we dug into the regions of Palestine, and the Gaza Strip is the lowest of all. And of course, it'd be even worse now. It'll be down in Afghanistan kind of levels. Israel's ranking did not go down more because we rank on the basis of the average of 3 years. Mm. If you had used just the current rating, you'd be out of the top 20. If you looked at the measures of positive and negative emotions, they have higher negative emotions after the October 7th than almost any country in the world. So it's any way you measure it, it's been a very serious hit.
So the big question for me is why the rankings for the United States dropped so much. It appears to be largely because of responses from Americans under the age of 30. They are much less happier than reported in previous years. What are the factors contributing to that?
Well, this is the first time we've really studied happiness by age in a systematic way in the report. It's the focus of the whole report. And so this results jumped out at us that in the group of countries that includes Canada, the United States, Australia, and New Zealand, they were unique in terms of the size of their drop in youth satisfaction. And they're all countries that rank much higher for the happiness of the old than the happiness of the young. Canada and the United States being the extreme cases, where in both cases, their ranks for the old, i.e. 60 plus, are 50 or more ranks higher than for the young. That's extraordinary.
Should we consider it a red flag?
Well, it's a flag, whether it's red, yellow, or green, but make sure you're on the right track as you start your engines. I take it as a wake-up call and need to press a reset button.
Yeah. Professor John Helliwell is one of the editors and authors of the World Happiness Report. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Ken Block was hired by the Trump campaign in 2020 to find evidence of widespread voter fraud. He didn't find any and was disowned by some Republicans as a result. His new book is called Disproven: My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the data that shows why he lost and how we can improve our elections. More when we return.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank. Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares Betterment's philosophy on investing.
No matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Get started at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
In November 2020, data specialist Ken Block got a call from the Trump campaign. Multiple investigations have found no evidence of systematic voter fraud in the 2020 election, but Block was asked to find proof that it happened. One claim was that more than 700,000 fraudulent votes were cast in Wisconsin, for example, and Trump's staffers wanted Block to provide evidence of that. But when Block investigated, he didn't find any evidence. He's written about this in his new book, Disproven: My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the Data That Shows Why He Lost, and How We Can Improve Our Elections. Here's his conversation with Celeste.
What was the job description that you got?
It was unique, and it changed. The contract that I signed asked me to look for evidence of voter fraud for individuals that were casting votes who were deceased, and also to look for evidence of people who voted twice, once in one of the swing states and once in some other state. Very soon after my contract started, like a day, the lawyer that contacted me and who executed my contract was doing his professional due diligence. He was asking me to evaluate claims of voter fraud that were brought to the campaign's attention by other people, to determine whether those claims were true or false. And I could not find sufficient evidence of fraud that changed an election result. We found small amounts of fraud, not enough to matter. And every single claim of voter fraud that Alex Cannon, the attorney that I reported to, that he brought to my attention and asked me to confirm, I was able to prove to him beyond a shadow of a doubt that each of those claims was false.
So let's talk about how you did that. For example, the allegations in Wisconsin, those more than 700,000 alleged fraudulent votes, how did you prove whether they existed or didn't?
So that one was the wildest claim that came to me. And what had happened was a group of self-described volunteers performed some amateur data analytics and arrived at the conclusion that 700,000 Wisconsin voters had illegally cast duplicate votes. On its face, it was a ridiculous claim, and it was wrong for a basic reason. The volunteers were looking at a file of mail ballot data, and what that file did not contain were the votes that were cast in person in Wisconsin, which added up to, guess what, 700,000 votes. So, but what's really interesting and telling about this particular claim, other than the wildness of it, was how it came to me. The volunteers gave the claim to a golfer who brought the claim to the manager of a Trump golf course, who forwarded the claim to Eric Trump, who sent the claim to Alex Cannon, who gave it to me and said, tell me why it's wrong. And that's a great example of what was happening in that time window in November of 2020, when people all over the country were contorting themselves, trying to bring forward the evidence to prove the claim that the election was stolen. And it was really, in my opinion, a mania in terms of the claims that were coming and from where. I mean, I had to handle claims forwarded by funeral homeowners, by John Eastman, by Sidney Powell. I mean, they came from everywhere. Some of them benign and some of them, in my opinion, malign. They were all wrong. And Cannon accepted that finding is true. He brought the totality of my work to Mark Meadows, who was Trump's chief of staff.
Yeah.
He told Mark Meadows that the campaign did its due diligence and could neither find enough fraud to matter, and that we disproved every claim of fraud. Meadows then, we're told through news reports, brought that finding into the Oval Office.
So you mentioned a number of people, including the lawyers John Eastman and Sidney Powell. Was the response different between different people when you came back and said, I have not found any evidence of these allegations?
Alex Cannon did some remarkable things. He told me that his decision was to make sure that my identity and my company's identity was not known because he didn't want me exposed to political pressure to deliver results that weren't there. And it's what allowed me to do the work that I did professionally and thoroughly. And I wasn't asked to custom deliver a finding that would have been ripped apart in court because it was wrong. Cannon and the careful lawyers that he worked with were at war with the lawyers like Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman. Now, I didn't know that while I was doing the work, but the ill will between those two groups of attorneys pops right out of the January 6th depositions, of which Cannon gave an 800-page one.
So the subtitle of your book is The Data That Shows Why He Lost and How We Can Improve Our Elections. And I want to get to the second half of that, because there's a lot of misinformation out there related to voting. Some people think immigrants who are not citizens are voting. Some people think, as you mentioned, that dead people's votes are showing up. What can you say to people who are worried about the security of our elections?
The way we conduct our elections is a little bit backwards for the age we live in now. What we have are 5,000 different election jurisdictions that have their responsibility for running their own elections. And sometimes we have states or even counties within a state doing the same thing in a different way and sometimes yielding a different outcome. So the lack of federal standards regarding things like what happens when you cast a vote early, but then die before election day? Does your vote count? And the answer to that's pretty shocking. In a third of the states, it counts. In a third of the states, it doesn't count. And the other third of the states don't consider this situation in their laws at all. Whether or not a vote counts in this scenario depends sometimes on which county within which state you live. And I think that there should be a standard for that whole thing. As far as should we be worried about election integrity, and I just used air quotes, not that your viewers could see that. Election integrity has one proper meaning, and that proper meaning is that the way the election is conducted is with the best possible cleanliness of the data and that the infrastructure involved with it is as shielded as it can be from bad actors trying to interfere, right? Election integrity has been misused and pretty openly used as a substitute word for election denialism, which is something else altogether. And you have to take my word for it. I'm really tired of re-litigating 2020. But there are things that we should do. And some states have excellent voter data. Nevada and Georgia have excellent voter data. And yet those two states were at the centers of all kinds of wild claims of voter fraud. In New Jersey, there are 25,000 registered voters who have dates of birth of 1800. And that's bad election integrity. It's not evidence of voter fraud. It's sloppy computer systems. A cleanup should happen, right? We can raise our game, and it has nothing to do with voter fraud, but it has everything to do with ensuring that we have the best integrity in that we can identify the voters so we can determine when they're deceased.
Before we go, to put this in the simplest terms possible from an expert who has looked at all of this data, is it fair to say the 2020 election that you don't want to relitigate was fair, that it was not stolen from Donald Trump, and that people should not be overly concerned of the influence of voter fraud on American elections?
The election was absolutely not stolen. In fact, Donald Trump's own words cost him the election. He made very clear that moderate Republicans weren't welcome in his orbit. He denigrated them as rhinos. And he basically told them to take a hike, which they did. It's a very simple explanation for why he lost. And the voter fraud claims that have no basis of foundation of fact are political theater. And they have nothing to do with what actually happened in the election.
Ken Block is the author of the book Disproven, about searching for voter fraud in the 2020 election and not finding it. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's our show. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Lynn Menegon, Hafsa Qureshi, and Julia Corcoran. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Peter O'Dowd, and Micaela Rodriguez. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on every purchase. Plus, earn unlimited 5x miles on hotels and rental cars booked through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
NPR Plus is a new way to support public media and get more from your favorite NPR podcasts like Fresh Air.
Sometimes I'll actually preface the question with, if it makes you too uncomfortable to talk about, if it's too personal, just tell me. Here's the question.
For behind-the-scenes content, bonus episodes, and more, sign up at plus.npr.org.